Hey, hey, have you heard? It's your host, Chris DeMakes, and I'm headed back to the Punk Rock Museum. That's right, the powers that be have invited me back, and I couldn't be more excited. Allow me to be your guide as we wind through 5 decades of punk rock history, merchandise, and memorabilia. Cinco de Mayo weekend, Friday, May 3rd, Saturday, May 4th, and Sunday, May 5th. There'll be 2 tours each day at 12:30 p.m. and 4 p.m. And the best part for me is you. Your stories, your questions, your experiences. Yep, some of you old punkers have taught this guy a thing or two on these tours, and I love it. Head over to thepunkrockmuseum.com for tickets. Don't miss out. Only 30 spots per tour. Get your tickets now at thepunkrockmuseum.com. Hey gang, today's guest is my friend, Karina Denike, best known as co-lead vocalist for the Berkeley, California ska punk band, Dancehall Crashers. Karina is currently the touring keyboardist and backup vocalist for NOFX. Today we take a deep dive into the song Go from the Dancehall Crashers' 1995 major label debut, Lockjaw. Karina tells a really interesting story behind the inspiration for the lyrics, and I couldn't have been further off in what I initially thought the song was about. We get into how producer Stoker would get the band excited and motivated in the studio, and how Karina could relate to his motivational tactics from a cultural perspective. We talk about why Lockjaw was the first Dancehall Crashers album not to feature a horn section, and my thoughts as to why there weren't horns are exactly in line with what Karina explained to me. So grab your dancing shoes and join us on this songwriting trip down memory lane.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast.
I've known you for a long time. I've really gotten to know you a little bit better the past couple years because Karina, for the listeners, has been playing keyboards with NOFX for probably the last 4 or 5 years now.
2016, I think, was my first show with them. So yeah, 2016. Yeah, 4 years.
They now have a real singer in the band besides Hefe. It's great.
Yeah, I know. It's an honor. It really is an honor. It's so fun. Everything about it. They're the best. I love all those guys individually and have known them obviously for a very long time, and they put out our records and Dancehall Crasher records, and I've sang a lot on different projects that Mike's been doing over the years, including Home Sweet Home and NOFX backup little, you know, guest spots here and there. So it's amazing. It's awesome. I love singing with Hefe. It's great.
That's very, very cool. Well,
thrilled.
Of course, you know, I met Karina back in the day when she was one of the co-front people for the Dancehall Crashers. And we're going to talk about a song today called Go that Karina wrote. It was on the album Lockjaw that was released August 29th of 1995 on 510 Records, which was a subsidiary of MCA Records. And prior to that, you had the record. Now, it's either called the old record or 1989 to 1992. I don't know the exact. I always called it the old record that was on Moon Ska. And you guys had a horn section at that point.
I knew this song. I knew this question was coming, and it was just a matter of time. But you went right to it.
Well, I went right to it because I wanted to get it out of the way, because I was one of those people, and this is an unpopular, possibly an unpopular opinion. No offense to whoever played horns on those early recordings, and I liked those recordings and I liked those songs, but I just didn't feel like you needed the horns. I felt that, you know, what you and Elise were doing vocally, that the horns just, in my opinion, didn't belong. I felt when I heard Lockjaw, I was blown away. I was like, Aww. Wow. Yeah, you know, it was really a step up from the previous recordings. So basically the first thing I just wanted to touch on was there a reason why there was such a gap between that first record and Lockjaw? Was it just trying to find a label deal?
There were a few things going on. So the old record is called the old record with the years in there, in part because when we re-released it on Honest Don's, you know, subsidiary Fat, when Fat Records basically re-released it, we added 3 songs that we had done in this sort of interim period. So the Moonscar album doesn't have Truly Comfortable and these 3 extra songs that we had been working on in that interim. So, you know, we were a band, then we broke up There were a lot of people in our band. In the 1980s, we had a series of lineup changes. Let's say like pretty much everyone in the Bay Area played in our band. And then we broke up, and then we had sort of done a little bit of stuff going on in between. But when we reformed, we had been playing without horns for a long time. Like, people had quit. We had gone through a series of horn players, some of whom you know. Mike Park was touring with us playing horn. Dean Olmsted from Let's Go Bowling did a couple of tours with us, or at least one with King Apparatus. We actually had T-Bone Willie from Save Ferris came to Hawaii with us and played with us on a U.S. tour.
And these guys were all ringers.
Yeah, but this is like before there were other, I mean, Mike Park and Dean were obviously in sort of, you know, successful bands, whatever, at that point. But, and T-Bone was too, but before, that was pre-Save Ferris, you know, the early days. Mm-hmm. And also Matt Morish was even playing with us, and he is in The Beat now, and he's been in The Beat for years. So cool. I think we were his first like ska band. So we were playing with all these people, and a bunch of people quit or went on to do other things or were busy with other things. And so we had this period where we were already playing without horn players. It was really expensive to tour with so many band members. We didn't have a label. So the reason it took so long in between albums is because we had broken up. Band members had left. We were sort of not really a band for like 2 years. We had gotten a lot of fan mail from kids after our Moon Ska album had come out. And we sort of were surprised to hear how many fans there were that we didn't even realize were out there. So we reformed in part to do sort of like a reunion show, we called it, at Slim's in San Francisco, and realized that we had sort of had this fan base that had developed over the time that we'd been broken up. So it was a few things going on. You know, we just kind of reformed after that. And so that's the long period of time. We weren't consistently a band that whole time.
It's those vocals. it was you and Elise. It's the way you guys were flawless. It's the way you harmonized. It just wrote me. I'm a singer first and a guitar player second. It wrote me in. There was nobody singing like you. Yes, there was female fronted ska bands, but not doing the harmonies that you guys were doing. It was just so good. And I always stuck up for you because I always said back then, I'm like, we're in the middle of this third wave ska revival. Everybody has horns. You got the Boss Tones. You got Real Big Fish. If anything, they're crazy for not having the horn section. They're not sellouts. And in my opinion, again, the horns didn't need to be there. I felt like the horns would get in the way for what you and Elise were doing vocally, which was just flawless.
Well, thank you so much. And definitely that is the other reason, is that there were a few reasons. So one was what I just mentioned, which was that people were sort of dropping off anyway, and we didn't really have a full band, and we were sort of hiring our friends to step in and do the horn parts. But the other reason was that we were listening to Op Ivy and Jawbreaker and the Muffs and a lot of bands, you know, that didn't have horns necessarily. We're a little bit more on the skater punk side, you know, Sublime, bands that were sort of like not focused on horns, let's say. And that's some of our influences were sort of some skate punk things at that moment, even though, you know, my roots are in sort of more traditional ska and reggae and that kind of stuff myself also. But then we had these two vocal parts that were really busy. We were writing all these crazy harmonies. We were doing a lot vocally and oohs and ahs when we weren't singing the lead and all kinds of stuff happening. And we had two guitar players, and we just felt like it was pretty busy already and musically busy, and we didn't need this extra sort of addition of trying to fit horn parts in and where would they go. And like, it was because of the dual lead thing that we were doing, we didn't feel like it was necessary as much. So exactly what you said.
I guess my instinct was right. I felt that. And when I heard Lockjaw, it was just such a step up for the whole band, the playing and everything. And we'll get into the producer, Andy Stoker Graucott, because I want to talk about him, which is very interesting.
Oh, yeah.
That's a whole conversation we'll get into in a moment. But this particular song, Go, 3 minutes and 10 seconds. Great little pop tune. Set it up for us. Do you remember where you were when the idea came?
Oh, boy.
does it involve a love interest?
No, I just...
Oh, okay, that was the look.
No, the question is, do I remember? I mean, the thing is, you know, it's like, do I remember where I was? No, like, I'm sorry, I don't remember where I was. This is one of those songs that sort of came about in that interim period where we were, you know, not signed yet to 510 and MCA. We were in that sort of middle period there. Jason was had been in Downfall with Tim Armstrong. That was sort of a band that had come out of Operation Ivy. So our guitar player Jason Hammond was in Downfall with Operation with Tim Armstrong, and I think he wrote this sort of, you know, these guitar part, this kind of the structure of the song, and that's how we wrote a lot of our songs, is that one of our guitar players, different people at different times, but Jason was always there throughout, and he would come up with parts and then sort of present them to us on cassette tape back in the old days, kind of just like come up with a bunch of ideas, and then Elise and I would sort of take them, and you know, one of us might be like, oh, I've got some ideas for this song, and the other one, I've got some ideas for this song. So that one, I think he was influenced. That's that dun 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 kind of major three chord like kind of hits. I think that's to me, that sounds very Op Ivy and Downfall. It's like, bum, bum, we're starting a revolution here. You know, not that that's what it is, but.
No, it's got that rancid vibe. It's the Matt Freeman, Tim Armstrong thing. I could totally see that.
Absolutely. And I kind of think that was musically a little bit of a nod for him to them, because, you know, we obviously thought they're great, and they did start the band. Yeah, which I'm assuming you know that.
I do know that. And just real quick for the listeners. Tim Armstrong and Matt Freeman, of course, from Rancid and Operation Ivy, were in the first incarnation of the Dancehall Crashers, and that was, I believe, in 1989 that they were a part of that. And you and Elise joined in 90, a year later.
Elise,
correct?
Joined before I did, and I don't know if we want to get into the history of that as well, but it's, she started, I think, Tim Armstrong had actually already left. There was a woman named Ingrid singing, and Ingrid and Elise sang together for a little while, then Ingrid quit, and my brother was friends with those guys. He's in the ska scene too, and he's a year younger than me, and they would, somebody was saying, oh, we need a girl singer. He's like, my sister's a really good singer, you should get her. So I joined about 6 months or 7 months after Elise, I believe, something like that. And So anyway, back to Go, which is that it was I think a nod to that sort of like that big guitar kind of intro. And then where I was, I don't remember where I was when I wrote the lyrics, but and the melody, but I know what they're about and all that kind of stuff, but I don't have my memory but that's where we were.
No, that's fine. I guess I'm more going for, of course, this is, I always say on the show, anything pre-YouTube, we could go out and play our songs to our fans before we recorded them. Were you playing this in a live setting before you ever stepped foot in the studio?
This one we were. A lot of the songs on Lockjaw, that's not the case. But this song okay. there was just a couple of songs on the album that we had been playing previous to writing the rest of the album. And this one in particular was, we had done a demo with this song and Truly Comfortable and a couple of, what else was on there? Maybe Othello, Next to You, Othello. Anyway, Go ended up going to Hawaii, and a demo of it ended up being on Radio Free Hawaii, which was huge. Like boost for us, like they loved us in Hawaii.
That was a massive station. so influential,
and they totally broke us in Hawaii. Like it was crazy. We went there before we did Lockjaw, so I was trying to remember all this. I was like, was it before or after? But it became this huge hit there, and that was sort of like another reason that we're like, well, maybe we should look for a label and get this together. Like, I mean, we were sort of there, but we weren't really, you know, I don't think we had all decided that we really wanted to make a go of it at that point. We were still sort of getting back into the band and seeing what it was like. So Go was just this huge hit in Hawaii. It was crazy. We went there and like everybody recognized us. We had this bizarre like Beatles moment, which was completely confusing to us because we have been playing, you know, for much smaller audiences anywhere else.
You can't get arrested 6 hours earlier in LAX. You land in Hawaii and you're mobbed.
Yeah, it was.
That's a weird feeling.
It's totally bizarre. I mean, everybody, you know, like the sort of like you'd go into a grocery store and like the guy working at the counter would know you, and like all these kind of weird moments. We went to, you know, the signing at record stores, and people are like lined up out down the block and screaming.
Cool.
Like, it was bizarre. It was really, really fun just to have this weird moment. But Go had been, we were playing it already. So that was already where we were at.
Okay, so the song lyrically and structurally was done before you stepped in the studio. Do you remember when you got in the studio, was there a lot of changes? Did the producer Stoker have a lot of changes to arrangement or anything? Was it pretty much what you were playing when you were in Hawaii?
It was pretty much, I think our earlier demos had a better sort of more prominent upbeats, and he didn't change any arrangement stuff. Stoker is super awesome, and we can get into him in a minute too, because he had a really positive influence on us and just on that whole record on Lockjaw. But this particular song, I don't think we did any real changes. There was some guitar, you know, like I said, upbeats were more prominent in the demo version, but I don't think we did any change in arrangement, really.
The reason I brought that up, this is a very different arrangement. And it's so funny. I never thought of this song as having a weird arrangement until I started to really analyze it. It just was one of your right. songs. It's a great song, but getting into it, I'm breaking it down, and I don't even exactly know what some of these parts are. Let's get into that right now. So the riff you're talking about with those hits, the dun, dun, dun at the top, it's a really quick 10-second intro. And I'll tell you, that riff, da-na-na-na-na-na, that is just the epitome of a ska riff, right? That just screams.
Yeah.
It's just so catchy and so good. And that was something that you said Jason had written.
Yeah, Jason had written that. I think that's sort of what I said his influence probably was, this kind of like epic sounding, like dun, dun, you know. And we had two guitar players, so I think they get fun with their upbeats and all that kind of stuff. But that's where that intro comes from. He created that sort of that vibe there for sure. That's his setup.
Right. And we start out with basically it's chorus one that starts the song off. Want to go with you, but I think I'll stay. Want to go with you, but I think I'll stay. Want to go with you, but I think I'll stay. Want to go with you, but I think I'll stay. And you don't need anything else there. It's catchy as hell.
Okay, I have to preface this with like, oh God, we're getting into the song that I wrote when I was 19 or something or 20. So let's just say, you know, not the best lyric writing of all time, but I obviously wanted this catchy feeling, and I mean, we can get into what the whole thing is about.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I had moved from, yeah, but like, I know it is weird that it starts with the chorus, because when I talked to you about doing this song, I was like, yeah. And then I listened back, I'm like, I didn't even realize that it really does start with the chorus, which is kind of unusual. Like, you don't always do that. Usually, especially Dancehall Crasher songs, we don't usually start with the chorus. We definitely had like first one, set it up, pre-chorus. There's no pre-chorus in this
song. No.
Then there's a, you know, the real chorus. Then you have a bridge. We don't even have a bridge on this song. So it's kind of a weird, it is a weird arrangement for us.
Very weird, but I mean, it just hits you right off the bat. The harmonies right off the top. But yeah, it's only one lyric, you know, want to go with you, but I think I'll stay. And I've had a few people on the show now echo the same sentiments as you of, oh, I wrote this song when I was 20. Yeah. And I relate to that. I relate when fans come up and they want me to sign the first demo we did or the first seat. I'm like, it's just right. But I always say that you got to think of it, and I have to dig deep. And it's gotten a lot easier over the years that I look at it from a fan perspective. And I know how much those early records of certain bands, you know, Crimp Shrine, 15, some of those bands, the you know, stylistically and production wise, it wasn't that great. But what those records mean to
me, for sure.
And what they mean to those fans.
For sure. And I appreciate it more as the years go by. I definitely agree with you on that. Yeah. And I think that, you know, there is an energy that comes with being that age when you're writing that is so important, that carries over these sort of like slight embarrassment about some musical or lyric choices that we were making as young people, still trying to figure out how to write a song. Like, we didn't know how to write songs. We were still like learning. And, you know, in this section, you know, I wrote all the melody and the lyrics for this, but I, you know, we would try different harmonies out, and definitely we went a lot into unison. And this was one moment, I think, you know, want to go with you, but I think I'll stay. You know, it's like, should we do a harmony on that? Want to go with you, but it sounds ridiculous. Let's keep it in unison and just go for it together. Like, it's a, but I think I'll stay. You know, we tried a few harmonies and everything just sounded ridiculous. So that's sort of like our coming in together as a unified voice there.
Wanna go with you, but I think I'll stay. That's great. I mean, people for years have been double tracking vocals on records. Why not do it live? And it seems like you picked the perfect balance with what to harmonize with. And I know you practiced your tails off. It's evident because I'm assuming 1995 and certainly your first record wasn't to Pro Tools, right? So this was all to tape.
It was all to tape.
Which means that, again, you had to be rehearsed.
Oh,
it wasn't going to get fixed in post-production.
Absolutely not. And I'll just say, you know, the training that you do when you're going to tape and in those years is vastly different to what people can fix now. So I also was really anal, and I was like, absolutely no way are we going to ever use auto-tune. Like, over the years, as we started being able to use it, I was really anal about it. I'm a little more mellow about it now. I just kind of like, well, there's little bits and pieces here. Maybe we'll do that. I don't know. But at the time, we didn't have auto-tune at all. We didn't have any of that kind of stuff. It was expensive or just problematic to use. It was clunky gear stuff.
Well, and there's some singers, I mean, you're really great. You know, I mean that. You know that you don't need it as a crutch. You can, if you had to use it as a tool, it's one thing, but it's not a crutch, which, as we know, a lot of singers use the technology as a complete crutch. You go see them live, you're like, that doesn't sound like the record.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a unfortunate thing because the people are using it almost obviously too much at this point. But anyway, but yeah, so it was all to tape. And Elise and I just had this. You know, I've been singing harmonies for years before that. I know she had been singing harmonies too. But my background is like just, I'm a harmony obsessed vocalist down the line, Toots and the Maytals, Beatles, Althea and Donna, you know, just Funboy 3, like all these bands that are just like, to me, the Staple Singers, like just completely obsessed with harmonies always. So I was coming in with that. And then we, like our first rehearsal, I'm really good at blending. I would like to say that about myself. So I'm having, well, just anyone that's harmonized for years, as you know, of course, as a singer, that you start to kind of develop learning how somebody's inflections go, how they end words, how they start words, how they're going to say certain words, like, you know, say their consonants, open their vowels, where they're placing, if they're singing like this or if they're singing like this. You know, I have a whole way that I sing with Elise that I think just sort of formed onto her voice and sort of opened up certain vowels in certain ways. So I'm pretty anal about it. And when we first started rehearsing, I feel like it just clicked immediately. And then this record, we did more multi-tracking, but in our old record, I remember going in and doing, I think our first song that we were recording together was Keep On Running, which was, it never made it on an album, but we did it together on the same mic, and it was like the very first day, like, let's see what happens, and we were just right on together.
Well, yeah, I went back and listened to a couple tracks. I put Nuisance on, and I just was just, I was floored, because again, I knew it wasn't done to Pro Tools. I knew this was cut to tape, and it was just great.
Hard to keep him from hanging around.
I saw you live back in the day, and you were flawless live, so I knew you could pull it off. Here's the first arrangement snafu for me. I don't know if snafu is the right word, but where it gets interesting, it's the same chord progression. So the last time you say, want to go with you, but I think I'll stay. It's still going, but the lyric changes to, it's been 10 years since I left my home and wandered off without you. And then it breaks down. I'm calling that a post-chorus. or is that the start of the verse?
It's funny. I would never have thought this song was so weird to dissect, but
it's a weird one. Is that the post chorus or is that the start of the verse? I don't know.
I would call it the verse because here's the beginning of the story, actual storyline. Like, what are you saying, Karina? Want to go with you, but I think I'll stay. I'm so confused. What the hell does that mean? I'm totally don't understand, Karina.
But the melody changes and the first two lines are still over the chorus guitar progression.
Well, maybe we hadn't thought of any other chords to play. No, I'm just kidding. No, I think, you know, it's the sort of like out the gate kind of chorus. And then the more reflective, I'm going to tell you the story about what's happening here in this song. So I kind of think of it as the verse.
And you wrote the song. It's a verse. We're going to go with that.
That's
it's a
right.
verse.
Don't getting fight into, me.
Getting, I, no way.
Don't fight me on that.
Getting into the I'm going to read the whole verse now in context. And it's been 10 years since I left my home and wandered off without you. Has it been that long? It's really been that long. And in the back of my mind, I still hear you calling to me, shouting to me, grabbing my attention. So it's at this point I'm going to ask you, what was this song about?
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. This is Tuck from Fit for a King, an off-road minivan. Every week, I bring you fun interviews alongside your favorite metalcore entertainers with my new podcast, Get Tucked. Join me every Monday with bands like Counterparts, Crystal Lake, like Moths to Flames, and many more. We play unsigned and undiscovered bands, deep dive into each artist's history, and of course, provide the greatest breakdowns in current metalcore. Tune in to Get Tucked every Monday, out now through Sound Talent Media.
So this song, I moved when I was 12 years old. I moved from England, from Cambridge, which was a small town in England. And my father lived in London, and I was living in Cambridge with my mom and my brother, and we moved to the Berkeley, Oakland area. So we moved to the States, emigrated, totally, you know, big shocking sort of change in my life just to be now in the States after a very sweet little English childhood. So this song is actually about, you know, it just had been about 10 years. So it'd been 10 years since I left my home and wandered off without you. Has it been that long? It's really been that long. It was sort of like, wow, it's, there we go, 10 years. And so this was actually a couple of friends, but one person in particular, I think that it was really focused on, a dear friend that was there. And I kind of felt, and I say this because I don't like some of the intention about this song, but it was sort of like this feeling of like being stuck in this small town, to a friend that I think wanted more in their life, and wanted to, you know, maybe pursue music or maybe pursue some mm-hmm. other things in their life. And they had been sort of like not sure what to do and sort of stuck in this smaller town. And I felt a little bit like, you need to get out of there and go explore the rest of the world and go explore life or move to London or move out of that small town mentality. So that's kind of what the whole song is about. But this particular part of the verse or part of the song is, you know, I left and it's really been that long. And in the back of my mind, I can feel you know, I can still hear you like calling to me, shouting to you, like trying to kind of bringing me back to that small town mentality. And you're sort of like calling out to me. And when you move when you're a teenager, you have a lot of nostalgia about where you left. It's a deep, you know, a deep kind of,
well, especially that culture shock back then, Karina, the world wasn't homogenized. You didn't have a phone in your face. Going from Cambridge back then to the Bay Area had to be just like you were shell-shocked.
Totally shell-shocked.
Like,
I mean,
yeah, what the hell is this?
Honestly, going to junior high and in Oakland schools was just mind-blowing.
And I'm assuming you had an English accent at this point.
Oh, yeah. I was teased. I would say things like, does anyone have a rubber that I can borrow? You know, and people would be like, what? Girl, what are you saying? And so they'd be like, sort of, huh? You know, it was like an eraser. Oh, an eraser. You know, like, I mean, just like so many faux pas and so embarrassing. And I just like looked wrong and I just had this funny accent and it was really hard. It was really hard. But of course, so as at this point when I wrote this album, felt like my mom had made the right choice. She came to the Bay Area, she came to the States, and she was like, this place is full of soul and music and art, and people can be free to do what they want to do. And, you know, she's a very dynamic, both of my parents are very dynamic and artists and really real eccentrics. And I think she just was like, we got to get out of there. And, yeah. And this is the place my teenagers need to be. Which was totally true. So I think I was like in the back of my mind, I hear you calling me and, you know, grabbing my attention and like, and the want to go with you, but I think I'll stay is that friend of mine saying that she wants to go with me, but she's going to stay because she's doesn't have the guts to get out or the, you know, the sort of, you know, yeah, just the impetus to sort of like leave a comfortable environment. And yeah. And go out into the world. So that's what this song is about.
Well, writing this, you know, as a younger person and feeling a little, I don't know, embarrassed or about it, but that's a pretty mature stance for, and I thought this was a love song. I was completely off the mark. completely off the mark. So I think that's really cool, the inspiration behind this lyric. So verse one into chorus two is the only time in the song that it goes right into the chorus.
Right.
It's only time. And again, you get four lines of "wanna go with you, but I think I'll stay." And then it goes right into the start of the second verse, still over the same chord guitar progression. Mm-hmm. You say you feel trapped and do not see an answer to the problem. I say you got to get out. Just get up and get out. What are you afraid of? Living, loving, hurting, crying. It's one and all. Defend your fate. Your destiny can be. And we'll stop there before I go to the next part. I'm getting these lyrics now.
Yeah.
After you set it up.
Right. So that's what they all say, except there's one big, not big issue, but one funny little comment here. But so, yeah, you say you feel trapped and do not see an answer to the problem. I say you got to get out. Just get up and get out. Like, it was just, come on, get out of there. Right. And so that's me talking to her. What are you afraid of? Living, loving, hurting, crying, like you're just, your fears are holding you back. It's one and all. And then this was supposed to be befriend your fate. And that's actually the lyric. However, this was a weird moment in the recording process where somehow Elise had been, you know, a lot of times we would, one person would sing like all the way through the song and the other person would come and match them and do, you know, overlaying. Somehow her part was recorded first, and she thought the lyric was defend your fate. So she put defend your fate, which is totally incorrect. I was so upset. I was like, no, it's not defend your fate. It's befriend your fate. But her vocal was already on there. And so we just kind of went with it. And I think even in the recording, I'm sort of saying befriend your fate. Like I'm sort of softening that. So it's hard to hear that it's really defend.
What are you afraid of? Living, loving, hurting, crying. It's one and all. Defend your fate. Your
I thought that I was wronged by the internet lyric machine again. That happens sometimes here.
No, it's actually that she's saying defend your fate. And the real correct lyric was supposed to be befriend your fate. Like, okay, you know, make peace with your future and like, or, you know, befriend what's to come and get out of there and be brave. So that was sort of whatever, not that big of a deal, but it was kind of funny. It's like defend your fate. That doesn't actually lyrically make any sense to me. So there you go. There's one little thing. And then your destiny can be what you make it.
And that next part, what you make it, you say it four times and the whole band changes here. The whole feel, it kind of almost feels like it kind of slows down. It gets a little sludgy. It's just a different feel for the song. Is this a bridge or is this a post-verse or is this a pre-chorus? Because the chorus is next. I almost feel like this is bridge one. It's because I always call the bridge the departure, and this feels like a departure for me. But usually bridges don't go right back into the chorus, so that kind of stumps that theory.
I guess it's almost to me like a second chorus, although I would say probably let's call it a bridge because it does happen twice in the song. It ends the song, doesn't it end the song? Yeah. So in a way to me, it's like a sort of second chorus in a way. It's like, what you make it? It's just like a halftime. What you make it? You know, and then that's my big moment to go, what? To hit this really crazy high note. Which I don't know if you can.
Which, but by the way, I've never told you this. You know, your pictures back in the day, you'd have your little dresses on. You both looked great, and you looked just kind of sweet in your promo pictures. But you looked menacing live when you'd sing. You'd get this scowl, and you would just dig. I remember the first time seeing him, like, whoa, I wouldn't mess with her at all. Did anybody ever tell you that?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
The funny thing
you look tough. You look tough.
I mean, that was definitely what I was trying to portray. I mean, not to be like, just to put myself back in that time period. It's why it's, I think, would be hard for us to do a reunion because I just don't feel like I'm quite the same person anymore. It's like, but you know, I was incredibly, and Elise is super duper tough. If you ever have encountered her, which, you know, all of our touring buddies have, she's an insanely strong, tough woman. And so I think I looked a little meaner because I was doing a lot of scowling on stage, but I think she's probably the tougher one of the two of us. But we both have a really strong personality, and I really wanted to be, you know, the people that I looked up to as performers, you know, Bowie, Tina Turner, all kinds of, you know, strong, like performing musicians and singers that I thought were phenomenal. That,
well, plus, you know, the punk rock scene that you were immersed in. I mean, exactly. There was some tough dudes that were in that scene, you
exactly
know?
And you know, female punk rockers, Susie and the Banshees, you know, there's like kind of like this you know, Debbie Harry. Mm-hmm. There's this sort of, you know, like gotta get your sneer on and be like the slits and like be, you know, be a little bit of a tough girl. And also just to show other women that, like, and men, doesn't matter, just that I wasn't a little sort of like wallflower that was ready to scared to be on there. And I felt, yeah.
That's awesome.
I felt like it was like, we gotta fucking do this. Like, come on. And, yeah. And I also felt like the minute you get on stage, you gotta like...
You gotta bring it.
You gotta bring it and own it and put on a fun show. And
yeah.
So yeah, there was a lot of sneers. That's what I think we.
Okay.
Got.
Well, I'm glad I'm not the only person that said you. I didn't really. I wanted to say that. And I'm like, ah, should I say that? But
no.
Yeah, you look tough. You know, and I made a mistake here a moment ago. I said it goes into the chorus. It does not. So after this, what you make it part, there's kind of this eighth note guitar chugging comes in for one measure. And yeah. Then a guitar solo happens, and the solo is really cool. It's a little departure, comes in. Catchy as hell.
Kind of rockabilly a little bit, isn't it?
Kind, yeah, it's got the very, very rock and roll, rockabilly. And then it comes back into the chorus.
Right.
And there's hits here. So it's "Want to go with you, but I think I'll stay." It's like a hit. And then mm-hmm. "Want to go with you, but I think I'll stay." And then the band stops again.
Want to go with you, but I think I'll stay. Want to go with you, but I think I'll stay. Want to go with you, but I think I'll stay. Want to go with you, but I think I'll stay.
Were those hits always there originally when you played it? Or again, was this something that Stoker or anybody brought to that? Do you remember if those stops were there?
I think it was one of the final arrangement ideas that we had come up with pre-Stoker. I mean, I think we were, it's sort of like coming back, not into the full normal chorus, but "Wanna go with you, but it's wanna go with you, but I think I'll stay. Wanna go with you, but I'll..."
Yeah.
You know, this kind of back and forth between the fast upbeats and the kind of dynamic stalls or whatever you'd want to call them.
I really like it, and I think it was needed, and it's weird. In context, again, this is the third chorus of the song, and it's the last time it happens. And after the third chorus, it comes out of that with the stops. It comes into a third verse
right
now.
Right.
So, and the lyric to the third verse is, "And you come to me with propositions like you really mean them. Well, I've heard them before, so many times before. What are you afraid of?" And then we get some of the other verse here. "Living, loving, hurting, crying. It's one and all. It should be befriend, but it's defriend. Defend your fate.
Befriend.
Your destiny." Yeah. "Your destiny can be." So the first couple lyrics here, "And you come to me with propositions like you really mean them." Are you speaking to your friend at that point still?
Yeah. I'm basically speaking to her the whole time, and her voice is, "Want to go with you, but I think I'll stay." And then mm-hmm. I'm talking back to her. "It's been 10 years since I left my home." And then "You say you feel trapped and don't see an answer to the problem." Second verse. And the third verse is, "And you come to me with propositions like you really mean them. Like you're going to get out of that shitty small town." And by the way, Cambridge is not a shitty... I love Cambridge. But, you know, the small town mentality.
I love it too. It's a beautiful city.
It's beautiful, but it's not a place to grow into an artist easily. It's, you know, it's got its limitations, just like any smaller mm-hmm. town. It's a nice place to be a child. "You come to me with propositions like you really mean them. Well, I've heard them before, so many times before." It's you know, it's just kind of like her saying maybe that she wants to leave there and go, you know, be an artist or be out in the world and do other things. And she's just, you know, "I've heard them before. Like, come on, get it. Just make it happen." It's sort of me talking to her again. Yeah.
Gotcha. And the song ends with the "what you make it" part. And here written in my notes, I had "bridge 2 ? Post verse ? Or outro ? Is this the outro of the song?
I don't think it's the outro because nothing's changed since the first bridge musically.
Good point. You're right. Okay.
So I consider an outro like the end of like "He Wants Me Back" or something. We go into this like sort of like back call and answer, like improv part or whatever, like vocalese part. "Oh, oh, 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 o song, it doesn't have what I would structure as a real bridge, because it's not that one time departure that I think a lot of Dancehall Crashers songs, we really tried to write bridges. Like that was a thing, like, okay, let's really try to write a bridge that really departs from the rest of the song and sounds different. We don't have that. It's over a lot of the same chords throughout the song. we don't really go anywhere.
This song, I think, structurally is great because it goes by quick. It's 3 minutes long, which isn't that long, but this song is just, the parts just seem to happen fast. You press play and it seems like it's over. The end of the song, the outro, very outro of just music, is the intro again, but it's only half as long. It's just dun, 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 boom. It just ends abruptly, and it's just tough. Really, really like it. Always love this song. I was glad that you picked it, because it's one of my favorites from Lockjaw. I do want to talk a little bit about Stoker, because I'm trying to research him. He didn't have a Wikipedia page, and I dug yesterday for information. And Andy Stoker Graucott originally played in Dexy's Midnight Runners, and for the listeners, they originally did the hit "Come On, Eileen," which it's just amazing. I did not know the backstory of him. After he left Dexy's Midnight Runners in 1984, he formed with English Beat members Dave Wakeling and Ranking Roger. He formed General Public, which is just blew my mind. Yes. I had no idea. Stoker went on to produce artists such as Sting, Ice Cube, but also ska acts like The Specials, Let's Go Bowling, and of course Dancehall Crashers. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that whole ska contingency there, is that how he was brought to the table? Was he your choice, or was it someone from MCA 510 Records?
So MCA was not super involved. 510/MCA was actually called a joint venture rather than a subsidiary, because Jeff Salzman, Elliot Kahn had been managing Green Day and the Muffs and Jawbreaker. Mm-hmm. And then they started a label called 510, which was centered in the East Bay. And that was sort of one of the reasons we were happy to go with them, because we felt like they really would actually understand who we were, which wasn't going to be the case if we went to just, you know, a straight major that like doesn't really understand ska and doesn't understand Gilman Street punk rock, which is where we had, you know, originated and so on.
And I got to say something real quick, not to interrupt you, Karina. I feel really stupid. So after 28 years of calling it 510 Records, earlier in the episode, I called it that, and you said 510, which is, of course, a Bay Area area code.
Right. So it's the East Bay.
You learn something new every day.
Yeah. So 510 was the East Bay phone area code. So
yeah,
510, whatever. So gotcha. That's why they were called that. And that's what we appreciate. It was like, yeah, Berkeley, Oakland in the house. Like that's our people, you know, Gilman Street and, you know, Op Ivy and Green Day and all the great bands that were coming out of there. So, but anyway, I don't even remember exactly how Stoker came through to us, but we had done some research into looking for a producer, and I think those guys, Elliot and Jeff, might have found him. But yeah, his history, and he's, you know, from Northern England. So immediately I hit it off with him just as being this kind of like hilarious guy to deal with. And like the fact that he really understood what we were doing in a way, like he loves pop music, like even more than I did. He was like, yeah, it's great. He's like, come on, let's do it. It's fucking pop. It's fucking brilliant. Come on. Just like swearing all the time, which I appreciate. This is an English thing too. It's like, I have to be careful not to swear all the time.
But there's such a, to this day, you know, you listen to a lot of the records that were made back then, and, you know, a lot of records from that time period, I love them because they hold memories and speed, but sonically, they're not that great. Sonically, this record holds up, and there's a youthful exuberance to it. Do you still feel that? I know it's hard to go back and listen to your own stuff, but this record sounds great.
Thank you. I think that it really does. I think that we put a lot of work into trying to keep up this energy. It doesn't sound to me the way that we sound live, which was problematic for us. Like we were really trying to get that energy that we have live, which we kind of got a little bit closer to on later albums, I think. But you know, having said that, and I'm not totally crazy about some of the mixing and so on, but having said that, Stoker himself was our producer, and he gave so much life to this album. And he really, I think, understood this sort of like exuberance that we wanted to get out of it and the pop mentality. And his background, so awesome. I mean, the drummer of Dexy's Midnight Runners, another song that like I love by them is Gino. It's one of my favorite songs of all time.
Stop my turn, the stage is Star Wars. is my high.
So he really understood the musicality and the background that we sort of were coming from, you know, and that was huge. And he just had a lot of positive and great little ideas, like mini little things like, no, you just, when you go to the bridge, just go for it, fucking go for it, or stuff like that, or like, take it, you know, take off with it, and things that we really needed to kind of make us feel as a band like, oh, okay, like, let's shift it out of what we have a strong, you know, sort of musical idea, but we needed that extra sort of energy and a slight difference of where to take things at times. And obviously he's a drummer, and he had great parts for, he didn't come up with like writing very much, but of course, but he, you know, he sort of like focused on the guitar players getting, because we had Scott Goodell on this album, mm-hmm. Who was only on this album, who's a killer guitar player, great musician, great singer. And Mikey Weiss, it was his first album with us as a full album. And Stoker just really added so much. Like, he understood the ska thing, obviously, which a lot of producers maybe wouldn't, like sort of more modern producers, you know, like if we'd gotten some pop producer, like a lot of, you know, like No Doubt got great people, but I don't know if they, whatever, just everybody had different things on major labels that they were dealing with. So it was a 510 based, we were coming from a bit more of an indie label feel, I think, which was helpful, but with some backing.
Yeah, well, I think it sounds great, and not to overshadow, any of your achievements as a band, but in my opinion, my humble opinion, I think that the rest of the world should have been like Hawaii. You guys deserve to be known so much more. The band was great. You were great live.
Thank you.
And I'm really, really stoked that you were able to come on and talk about this song today. Before we go, I'd like, you know, would you like to leave our listeners with anything going on with you solo, any of your solo projects, No Effects, or possibly in the future, Dancehall Crashers?
Dancehall Crashers, pretty unlikely that anything will happen with that. You know, we're all still on great terms, but we all have our busy lives. And every time we try to do, you know, one little thing that we think we're going to do, like, let's release Honey, I'm Homely on vinyl. Or like, we have these little ideas that we want to get together, and it just kind of falls apart. But, you know, I'm doing tons of work on my own. Obviously, I've been touring with NoFX and singing on albums with them. So we just, you know, they just released the Frank Turner NoFX split earlier this year. And I mean, early 2020. And I'm just I get to play with them, but I'm also, which is phenomenal and amazing. But also performed on tracks with Fat Mike on Home Street Home, which is the musical that he's been writing. And then I'm also, a solo artist. So I have my own band, which has been on hiatus a little bit. But I released a self-produced album called Under Glass on my own, which is...
I have it. You gave a copy.
That's right. That's right. So that's kind of a weird combination of musical styles in there. But I sort of got to like, oh, well, I'm going to try all the things I like. You know, a little bit of 50s pop, you know, rock and roll, and a little bit of... a sort of sea shanty stuff, which I hear is a big hit on TikTok right now.
There's a track on there that sounds like it was recorded in 1940, and I mean that with the utmost sincerity. It's just the your voice, the production, I mean, everything about it, you just captured that time period. It's a really, really interesting record.
Thank you very much. And yeah, and I'm just doing a lot of collaboration, like video things with like Mikey and his uke. I just cool. Which has been really fun when you know you get to perform with lots of great people, you know, guys from the Interrupters. And I'm also, I just did a podcast opera, modern opera called The Electronic Lover, which is this really bizarre, hilarious piece written by Beth Lissick, who's an amazing author, and Lisa Metzakappa, who's an amazing composer. And it's like this about chat rooms in the 1980s. And it's this weird opera piece that's really modern with a bunch of voices that's like, very, very difficult to sing. I recorded that, and I'm working on a new and a bunch of things like that. I've been doing some collaborations with Alex Desert and Jesse Wagner from Hepcat and from the Agrolites.
Cool.
We've been doing some like doo-wop songs, and then I'm working on another solo thing that should be out this year soon called Where We Met, and it's just going to be some covers, but some older jazz tunes and some some other pop songs. I'm not going to tell you what the song list is right now. So I'm always constantly working on 50 million things, I would say.
Good for you. Good.
I get bored easily, so it's nice to vary things.
Well, once again, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun to dissect a go with you today and catch up. I appreciate it.
I do too.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is submit your song and bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured band is the Rosedales from Chicago, Illinois. They have my vote for best band member name so far on the show. On vocals and guitar is Rip Phantom. On vocals and bass, Mark Danger. On guitar, Johnny Crypt. And on the drums, Christian Danger. Here's a snippet of their song, Stars Are Falling.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
So it's really easy to be overly critical of songs you wrote and lyrics you wrote when you were younger. And I was feeling that coming from Karina a little bit during this conversation. But the fact of the matter is, the lyrics to Go are actually really great. And she might not see that from her perspective. Or maybe she feels like a little bit like, these are just young lyrics. But man, I think they're really good.
I agree, Chris, on first glance. And I even said this in the episode. I said to her that I thought this song was a love song. Just at first glance. And when she started saying that, hey, I wrote these when I was young, I was thinking, yeah, it's, you know, her first puppy love or her first crush. And she's embarrassed about it. But then hearing the story behind the lyrics, it's pretty deep for a young songwriter. I think these lyrics are great.
I think they're really good. And I especially like the line, what are you afraid of? Living, loving, hurting, crying. It's one and all. Defend your fate. Your destiny can be what you make. And it's funny that you got into that defend versus befriend your fate, because honestly, it's crazy. Befriend your fate is such a better line, and it's what it was actually supposed to be. I love that. Just befriend your fate in general, I just think is a great thing that I've never heard before.
It is a really great lyric, and it's funny how Elise sang it wrong, and it just ended up being that. And I've had that happen in the studio before, where I've sang something wrong, and the producer or someone will say, no, I think that's better in that case. You know, it's just, you never really know when you're under the microscope, so to speak, of the studio. But I think that the lyric overall is great. She has nothing to be embarrassed about with this lyric.
I loved Lockjaw when it came out. I told Karina off mic, like after the interview, I first heard Dancehall Crashers on a CMJ magazine, came with a little CD, and Enough was on it. And I got Lockjaw, and I just loved that album front to back. And when I heard she wrote Go, it's kind of funny. I actually listened to that album front to back, and a lot of times didn't realize what the names of the songs necessarily were. But when I went, I'm like, okay, which song is Go? And went and listened to it, I'm like, oh, yeah, my favorite song on the album. I mean, I really love Enough, too. I got to give Enough some props. But Go is the jam. This is such a good song, man.
As I said to her, I love this record, much like you, front to back. When I first heard it, I still think it's a great record. When I mentioned early on about the horn, she's like, oh, got to get that out of the way. I knew this was coming, because they got hammered with that in the 90s. You know, the whole cries of sellout, and I can't believe they got rid of their horn section. To me, if anything, they would, like I told her, they would have kept their horn section, because that's what was selling. That's what, you know, and I don't think they needed them, due to the fact that their vocals are so prominent and the harmonies are so great. And she even echoed that sentiment, which I'm glad that they did, because I don't think they needed the horns.
Did these people in the 90s never hear Operation Ivy before?
I know, right?
Like, yeah, I mean, and it's crazy that Tim Armstrong and Matt Freeman were founding members of Dancehall Crashers. You know, I never knew that until I started doing some research for this episode. Never knew.
Well, it's not a really known thing. There was no recordings with them ever put together. It was in between Op Ivy and in between when they started Downfall, which that album was never released. And then, of course, they became what is now known as Rancid. So this was kind of a lost little footnote. out.
Yeah, Downfall, man. I knew Downfall. They had one song on this compilation CD. I don't even know what label put it out, but it was called Can of Pork was the name of this comp, and there was a Downfall song on it. And I remember it was real, like, kind of like mid-tempo, and it was like, yeah, Downfall. And I mean, it was great. It was very, like, slower Operation Ivy. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, she comes, you know, from that whole Northern California East Bay scene, and there was just so much going on back then, and everyone kind of knew everybody from that scene. Even as big as it was still close knit. You had Lookout Records, of course. Fat Records was born out of there, and a ton of other labels. You had Gilman Street, just classic venues, and these were things that I was reading about as a young kid in Florida, and it was just like fantasy world to me, like the thought of ever getting out there and ever meeting some of these people. And she grew up with all of them, and what a place for her to land, coming from Cambridge, England, which it couldn't have been. Right now in 2021, it couldn't be more different. But back in the 80s when she moved, it just, like I said, there wasn't, you know, at the tip of your fingertips, you just can't go, oh, what's the fashion like in England right now? You didn't know. And she landed over here. Had to be complete culture shock.
I can't even imagine, like you said, it's like a fantasy land, imagining growing up in like the Berkeley area and going to Gilman Street, the characters that must have been around, and like, you know, the people everybody knows. And dude, I gotta tell you, like, Pittsburgh, we had our punk rock scene or whatever, and you had those people that, like, you knew who they were. Like, for example, this is funny, but there was a guy that was known as Goatface. Yeah, like Goatface, you know. and like, just people that were like almost characters, you know. And I can't imagine how many of those existed at Gilman Street and Berkeley in the early 90s, like late 80s, early 90s. And Karina got to go experience that. What you and I imagine being this, like, I don't know, like a movie almost.
Yeah, it was unattainable to me as a young kid. I just never, ever thought. And of course, you know, getting out there in the band and playing shows and meeting a lot of these folks, meeting a lot of my heroes and being able to talk to them and talk to somebody like Karina. I've gotten to know her. And when we were setting up this podcast, Chris, I don't know if I told you this, but you know, we were texting back and forth, and I started getting into the song and Lockjaw, and I was telling her, I said, listen, I got a fanboy for a second. I told her some things, and she's like, you never told me this. It's like, well, no, because you're my friend, and I'm kind of embarrassed about it. But I loved that band. I really did, and I meant what I said. I think that they should have been a way bigger band. They were awesome, especially live.
Yeah, man, I fanboyed a little bit too off after the conversation. Got to talk to Karina for a few minutes there because I really love Dancehall Crashers too. Amazing band. Dude, one thing that I thought was crazy too is I didn't know about this whole Hawaii thing. I didn't know that this radio-free Hawaii or whatever you were talking about. I didn't know about the Hawaiian scene. I knew that bands went to Hawaii sometimes as like part of touring, but I didn't know this was like a thing that broke bands.
Oh, Voodoo Glow Skulls were big over there. Our first time there in 97 or 98... 97, it was massive because not that many bands get to the island. There's not that many places to play. It's really expensive to fly all the way there. And it's just, it back in the 90s, Ska was so big and it had just such a great scene in Hawaii. There was a band called the Tantra Monsters from Hawaii that were just massive in Hawaii, but no one really knew them on the mainland. I remember Skank and Pickle taking them around for a tour. I saw them. I saw the band in Gainesville, and they were great. But many bands had a great, I say career, had a great turnout in Hawaii that maybe didn't have great turnouts elsewhere.
Wow, that's wild, man. That's one of the only states I've never played. I've never played in Hawaii or Alaska. Have you played? You've played in Alaska, right?
Yes, yeah. Did the Warped Tour in Alaska.
Wow. Have you played in all 50 states?
The only state that Less Than Jake hasn't played in is Mississippi.
Yeah, I haven't played in Mississippi either, I guess. Or I don't know. Maybe we did. I don't think we played in North Dakota. But yeah, I think we've done like 43 or 44 of
Punchline's
them.
Huge, yeah. In North Dakota.
Yeah, yeah. we toured with the Spill Canvas, yeah. Back in 2019. They are, I forget what magazine, it was Rolling Stone or Spin or something, but it was the biggest band of all time from every state. And apparently, I don't know, I'd have to look at the stats or whatever, but apparently the Spill Canvas is the biggest band ever from South Dakota.
I believe it.
I think Pennsylvania was Boys to Men, but yeah, I don't know. Florida was obviously Tom Petty, but yeah, South Dakota was Spill Campus. That's pretty sick.
Interesting. I would love if the first time the Punchline went to North Dakota, you guys sold out a 20,000 seat arena.
That'd be all the guys working on like the pipeline.
Yeah,
really love our love songs of Punchline.
Yeah, but ever since you got played on Radio Free Dakota, things are really blown up.
Yeah. And you know what else I want to blow up, Chris?
What is that?
This month's fundraiser at ChrisToMakesADifference.com.
That's right. The fundraiser for the month of March. The Superhero Center for Autism is a nonprofit organization offering support, education, and resources for individuals with autism and other special needs and their families. They have opened a community center in the Rockford, Illinois area where kids with special needs can just be safe, be empowered, be supported, and be themselves. This is a judgment-free place open to all kids with special needs and their families. This is a wonderful, wonderful fundraiser to get behind. If you can, please go to ChrisToMakesADifference.com. That'll link you to their page, and you can make a donation.
Like we always say, even if you can just chip in a buck or two or 10 or 20 or whatever you can afford, it always goes a long way, and we're really glad to be helping out at the Superhero Center for Autism this month.
That's right, and just to let everyone out there know that's donated, from the bottom of our hearts, Chris and I want to thank each and every one of you so much. We get wonderful letters from these organizations every month thanking us from the, you know, just up and down how excited they are to be working with us, and it's all because of you and your contributions. So thank you very much.
Yeah, I always feel kind of bad when we get those because I want to be like, oh, it's our listeners. It's not really, it's not us giving all this money to these organizations. It is the listeners. So, you know, kind of with the transitive property, them thanking us, we are thanking you because it seriously does mean a lot.
Yep, it certainly does. And listen, a lot of you have been asking the past few months about advertising here on Krista Makes a Podcast, and we are now offering that. If you'd like to advertise on Krista Makes a Podcast, head over to advertising@soundtalentmedia.com. Shoot them an email over there. Once again, that's advertising@soundtalentmedia.com, and they will hook you up and get you all the info needed.
Yeah, whether you have a business or a band or, I don't know, anything you want to advertise, you can hit them up at advertising@soundtalentmedia.com, and they'll get you rates, and they'll tell you what you got to do, whether you want to record your own ad or you want Chris, or maybe you want me to read it. Maybe you're like, no, I don't want Chris DeMakes to read it. I want Chris Mafalius to read my ad because he is just great. So whatever you want, just hit up advertising@soundtalentmedia.com if you're interested.
Talk about bruising my ego, Chris. If you start getting more than me, that's going to kill me. Jeez.
I'll be very surprised if I get any, but I could always hold on to hope for that. I think also one more thing before we go. I think that everybody listening should add your host, Chris DeMakes, on Instagram. Because, man, I was looking at your Instagram for, we have some projects coming up. We were going through and looking at old pictures. You kill it on Instagram, man. You have some of the most ridiculous photos I've ever seen in my life. And you really go above and beyond on your Instagram. So if anyone hasn't added Chris yet, he's less than Chris D. on Instagram, I think you should give him a follow.
That's right. Give me a follow. I'd appreciate it. Thanks for the plug, Chris. I really appreciate that. That was really very, very nice.
Yeah, man. Yeah, and people can find me commenting on all your stuff, and they can add me, too.
There you go.
Find my name there. See? I'm not going to try to spell my name on the podcast, but you can find me. I'll always be like, man, you look so dumb in that picture or something like that. You know, something along those lines. But
it's a dysfunctional symbiotic relationship. Well, listen, we want to thank this week's guest once again, Karina Denike, for being on with us. It was an awesome episode, and we will see you next week.
One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we both celebrate and have a good laugh about bands and artists that had just one hit that we all know. Each week, we're joined by a guest from the world of music or comedy to learn more than you ever thought you would about some songs that you can't forget. And we decide if they brought the one-hit thunder or were nothing more than a one-hit blunder. Look, if you listen to the show, you're probably going to laugh, and I guarantee you're going to crush next time the bar has music trivia. Tag Team, Jane Child, Meredith Brooks, Looking Glass, Sean Mullins, Eiffel 65, EMF, Crash Test Dummies, Crazy Town, Chumbawamba. We have hundreds of episodes in our back catalog and a new episode each week, so pass the Dutchie, make sure you're connected, and subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your pods.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like the Lumineers, Ani DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask? Good
morning. I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon. Again.